Thank you very much. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. And Alan, thank you for that nice introduction. I'm glad you didn't leave, because I noticed when Martha spoke, everybody left. And the child within would get all upset if my abandonment issues would come out. And I had to tell my child within to get a life. And somebody asked me the name of my child within once, and I told him it was selfishness and self-centeredness. I read that someplace. I'd just like to say how grateful I am to be here. Again, I was at the second Altoona Roundup, and it was the first conference I ever spoke at. And Joe H. and some of the old guys were just so kind to me. And there's a feeling about this conference that I rarely see anyplace else. There's a, you know, I think it probably reminds me of the Alcoholics Anonymous I know better than anything. It's kind, and it's gentle, and it's friendly, and it's fun, and there's a lot of laughter, and I'm just really grateful to be here. My home group is a Midtown group in Wilmington, North Carolina, and my sponsor is Tom I, and my sobriety date is May the 13th, 1973. A week from today, well, I didn't do that. A week from today, I'll be 59 years old, and I'd like to give a special welcome to the our new members. I met a number of them. A lot of nice ladies came on the van and came to the meeting last night, and I met some of the young gentlemen who are kind of new to our program, and I want to tell you that you're in the right place. If you have an alcohol problem, this is the place to be, and if you think you might have one, this is the place to be, and hang around till you find out for sure. And I'll tell you how I was treated kindly, and I was treated gently, and all that. And I think that's the experience that you're going to have. And if you come to my home group in Wilmington, North Carolina, I promise you that's the kind of experience you'll have there. I am just so very grateful to be here. I want to thank Jerry for inviting me and the rest of the committee and for that lovely picture. And I don't know what to put in it, but I'll think of something. And I want to thank the other speakers. If you weren't here last night, you missed a wonderful talk. And Martha, our Al-Anon this afternoon, just terrific. Martha and I spoke together, I think it was like 18 or 19 years ago the first time. I just love her and love her story. And you're in for a treat tomorrow. Ray M. I've known Ray a long time. I have a funny story about Ray. I work a lot with guys in prisons, and I love going inside prisons, and I sponsor a lot of guys. And I'd work with a fellow who got out and went to a beautiful little town in the western part of our state called Kannapolis. He said, do you know an AA contact? So I gave him Ray M. And he called me back about a half hour later. He said, my mama said, that's the mayor. I said, yeah, but he does a lot of not drinking. That's what's important. It doesn't matter what we do for a living. What's important is that not drinking part. And you're in for a treat tomorrow, I promise you. I'll try to fill in between, but tomorrow's going to be something. I'm from Wilmington, North Carolina. That's where I live. Actually, I know I don't sound like I'm from North Carolina. Last weekend, I was up in northern Canada, and they thought I sounded like I was from North Carolina. But what I am is a naturalized citizen. I married a woman from North Carolina, and that's almost as good as coming from there. And my Al-Anon sends her best. Julia celebrated 18 years in Al-Anon the first of this month, and she just gets better and better at it. We have a marriage that's just tremendous. It reminds me so much of what I heard about today, and we've only been married 13 years, but it's just a tremendous marriage. And we sat down from time to time. We retreat and we try to figure out, you know, what's going on, and do 10-step work and inventory. And we discussed it at great length not long ago. And we decided that the reason our marriage is so good is because we share a common goal, and that's my happiness. I mean, it's the way it always should have been. And I don't know what's going to happen when she gets another 18 years, but I'm going to hang on to what we got, I'll tell you that. But I was born in Ohio. I'm the second child and the eldest son in a family of 11 children. I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church we went to. I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with bingo, but I'm not saying anything else. Okay? And I would have told you we were poor. And I was telling my friend Dick a story, and we were talking about surgery. You do that when you get old. You talk about surgery and stuff. I was telling him, my mother, we really were poor. I mean, I wish there were another word for it, but there isn't. But my mother was just an extraordinary saint, and she always had a smile on her face, and everything was always all right. I remember one time, I don't know if anybody remembers that radio show, Queen for a Day. You know, they bring people on, and they tell these sad stories and everything, and my mother would stand at the sink or at the stove or something like that, and she'd be crying. And I remember once a woman needed a car, and they got her the car. Somehow at the end, the right woman always won. And my mother said, "I'm so happy. She really needs a car." I said, "Mom, we don't have a car." And she said, "But we don't need one. That poor woman does." And that was basically her attitude about everything. And every day that I let her, she'd hug me and kiss me and tell me she loved me. And every day I let him, my father, who never told me he loved me, and it really bothered my child within. But every day that I let him, he spent time with me, and he's a wonderful man. And she used to, before dinner, just before we'd say grace, she would give us some sort of a grammatical rule of some kind. And she was going in for surgery, and we were all adults, and by this time, and we were all in Pittsburgh at the hospital, and they had already given her that happy juice they give you that makes you want to go to surgery. And she was laying on a gurney with that silly grin on her face, and they were just about to wheel her through the doors into the operating suite. And she said, "Wait a minute." And she got up on one elbow, and she pointed at us. She said, "Look at me, boys." And so we looked at her, and she said, "Remember, never, ever, ever end a sentence with a preposition." You know, the surgeon said, "I never heard anybody say that before on the way to surgery." But that's the kind of home I grew up in. And you know, there was something about me that that didn't permit me to recognize what it was. I mean, I had a thing in me that didn't recognize the tremendous amount of love that surrounded me. And I had aunts and uncles and grandparents and neighbors and... You know, when everybody started running out of food, we'd all get together and pull the food and eat. And they called it a picnic. And I looked at it as a last desperate grasp. And, you know, I just somehow knew that things weren't right. I also had something lived under my bed. I don't know if they had any in Georgia, but they bred them in Ohio. And at night, I could press my little ear against a mattress, and I heard it moving around down there, and I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed. And I was history, and I knew that. I mean, I intuitively knew things when I was 3 years old that other people didn't. And that's the way it was with me. I mean, how could I not see what was going on? And I'm convinced that that I used to call myself an inquirer. What I was a skeptic and a cynic, and I think that skepticism and cynicism is part of the spiritual illness that I suffered from. And I always saw what was wrong. I never saw what was right, and I prided myself on being a problem solver. I wasn't a problem solver, I was a problem picker. The way I solved problems is I ran. That's the way I solved problems, but I always saw what was wrong. And I never felt as though I belonged. And I've heard this from so many alcoholics. It's just an amazing thing. And I just never, ever fit in. And yet I was surrounded by all these people who were upbeat and happy and on and on. And my mother used to, read us stories every night. And And when there were so many of us, there were a couple of kids in the neighborhood who couldn't go home because dad was drunk or something. So my parents raised them too. They just kept moving people in who needed to be there. They'd line them up in bed, and sometimes she'd go in and recognize one of them weren't hers. And the girls would go through the bath upstairs, and the boys would go through the shower in the basement. And we had this routine. We'd throw our dirty clothes and she'd wash them all night and that sort of thing. But she went to every room where the kids were, and she'd read us stories based on our age and things. And I remember one of her favorite stories was a vision of Sir Longfellow. And she would tell us about this young knight who was handsome and had the nicest horse and all the rest of it. And he was going on the quest for the Holy Grail, and he was leaving the city, and a beggar came to him and asked him for some help. And this guy, being sort of a big-hearted kind of a guy, he tossed him a gold coin and went on his way. And about 20 years later, he came back pretty beaten up, and he had failed, and life had really done a number on him. And he came riding back and on his tired horse, and he encountered a beggar just before he got to town, and the beggar asked him if he could help him. And he didn't have anything left except his cape, and he got off his horse and he cut his cape in half and put half the cape around the beggar, who turned into Christ. And the lines were, "It's not what we give but what we share. The gift without the giver is bare." And my mother would tell us those stories all the time, and what a beautiful, beautiful, upbeat lady. And I'm thinking things like, what's a guy going to do with half a cape? And I somehow missed it. And I was also, I got into a lot of trouble. I'm not proud of this, but I was what you call mischievous. And I get into a lot of trouble. We went to this little high school, and I like to talk about my friend Sister Victoria. Sister Victoria was this little nun who used to run around and say silly things like, every boy's a prince and every girl's a princess because we have a father who's a king, just odd stuff. And we call each other Prince Keith and Princess Mary. And she was a librarian, and I remember she'd walk around this tiny little library like it was a library at Congress. It was like she was doing God's will or something. It was the strangest thing. And we used to spend time with Sister Victoria if we got into trouble. We'd serve our detention with Sister Victoria. And what we did with Sister Victoria is you had to make rosary beads, okay? Those are things that Catholics pray on. And so they give you wire and pliers and these little beads and things, and you make rosary beads. I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria, and she used to put me behind a magazine rack. She said I was a prince, but I was contagious. So I sat back there making rosary beads. For 4 years, I'm making rosary beads. And they would take these rosaries, and they would send them to the missions all over the world and things. And my rosaries were different. Your standard rosary has 10 beads in each decade, because decade means 10. And mine had 11 beads in each decade. So after 4 years, there were hundreds of mutant rosary beads out there. And she never caught on, So you can't leave without them knowing. So I had to tell her before I graduated. And I went to her and I said, "Sister, you know what I've been doing?" She said, "Yes, you sly little prince. You've been putting extra beads in all the rosaries, and I know why." And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I have the foggiest idea why I do this. And she said, "People all over the world are saying extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit." Don't you just hate people like that? And then she did something that terrified me. She took both of my hands in her hands, and she looked into my eyes, and she was an eye person. Spiritual people are eye people. I was a shoe person. I looked at shoes. She was an eye person. And she looked deep into my eyes and she said, "You're a very special child of God. And one day, he's going to send you all over the world and you're going to tell his children how very much he loves them." And I was terrified. I was terrified. I was a kid who had something who lived under his bed. I had no earthly idea what I was going to do with my life. I had a terrible speech impediment, and it was just awful. And this woman is predicting you know, fate like that. And I just remember I was just terrified, and because I didn't want anybody to have any expectations of me, because I had observed my behavior for 17 years, and I never lived up to whatever it was people were expecting of me. You know, I that summer, I left home. And the way you leave home when you grow up where I grew up back in the early 60s is you either go to college, and that didn't look very promising, or I had a brother a year younger who had had rheumatic fever and had a rheumatic heart and all that business. And so my sister was in college, and I knew that Dumb Denny was going to go to college. And so I was in between, so I decided to take an inventory. I'll never forget, I stood in front of the mirror, I took my shirt off, and I flexed my muscles, and I turned sideways, and I put my chest out, and I was 5'1" tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. Now, whatever else I was a born killer. So so I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and joined the Marine Corps, and just seemed right somehow. And I failed to tell my parents my plans, and the recruiter showed up. I wasn't yet 18, so my parents had to sign for me. And the recruiter showed up, and my poor mother just came apart like a cheap suit. The poor thing, she started crying and everything. And my father said to me, "Son, are you sure you want to do this?" I said, "Dad, I've been thinking about this a long time. 3 hours I've been thinking about this." And so they reluctantly signed. And I never forget, all night my mother cried, and she kept saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." And so... with that vote of confidence, the next morning, we got a taxi cab and went over to the Trailways or the Greyhound bus station in Wheeling, West Virginia, and I got on a bus and went to Pittsburgh. It was 60 miles away, and it's the second longest trip I'd ever been on, and I was terrified. And it was a bad year, so they took you if you had a pulse. So that afternoon, I was sworn in the United States Marine Corps, and I truly knew nothing about it. I knew nothing. Only thing I knew about the Marine Corps was they took a certain number of young men over here and drowned them in a swamp over in South Carolina. It's the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps. And I never forget that day. It was we were sworn in at 4 o'clock, and the train left at midnight. There were three guys in the Pittsburgh area who understood the big picture, and they weren't guessing at life like me. And they said, "Look, kid, we're going to go over and have a few beers and a sandwich before the train leaves." And I said, "That's just what I was thinking." You know, what I did was I had learned early on that there are people in the world who understand the big picture, and they know what's supposed to happen, and then there's me. And so what I do was I got so good at doing it so quickly after they did it, it looked like we were doing it together. So I was always on the alert. So I follow these guys over, and this is the second time I drank in my life. The first time I drank, I ought to tell you about that, because it's hard to be a member of AA if you haven't had anything to drink. A couple folks in my home group I question, but it's none of my business. I was 5 years old the first time I drank. I was at home. I didn't go out a lot when I was five. My father was watching us. He was watching me and Dumb Denny. Denny was four. My mother was out. She was either at the bingo or having a baby or something. And I guess Dad thought it would be funny. There was really alcohol around our house, because both of my parents had parents who had drinking problems. And so there was really alcohol around our house, but there was some in the refrigerator. And I think Dad thought it would just sort of be funny. And so he gave us each a beer. Nothing happened to me, nothing. Denny, on the other hand, was having a spiritual awakening. He was rolling around under the table singing "Mary Had a Little Lamb" and other drinking songs. And Dad kind of panicked, and he wrestled him to the ground and put his jammies on him and took him up and put him in his little bed. And he said, "Don't tell your mother about this. I'll take you to the movies." I said, "Well, I was game, because, you know, they don't negotiate a lot with you when you're five." Denny, though, could care less. He's carrying on and singing and having the time of his life. And I'll never forget this. Little Denny stood up and urinated on the bedroom floor. Yeah. I remember thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And you know, it's the saddest story. Denny just never made it. We're not proud of this, but you know, the truth is the truth. Denny grew up and did some very strange things. Think about this now. Denny went to one college. It gets worse. He had one major. And he graduated in 4 years. I never heard of such a thing, graduating in 4 years. You know? And he was offered a number of jobs where he went to graduate school, graduated first in his class in graduate school. You know? And he was offered a number of jobs, and he took one. You know? And he retired about 5 years ago. He was a senior vice president in a large international corporation. And the strangest thing of all was he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers. You know? I had to work at this thing. I was 21 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor for the first time. So we go into that bar in Pittsburgh, and that's where my life changed. That's when I found out what was wrong with me. What was wrong with me is I was sober. And that night I discovered that being sober was not a normal state of affairs for me. And somewhere between the second and the third drink, my life changed. And it changed in a way that was to dictate the terms of my life from then on. I didn't know it was alcoholism. I didn't know that my experience was significantly different than the experience of the guys who were with me. You know, it was interesting about that. 4 years later, when we were discharged, all four of us were again together. We had all made the same rank. Not one of us had seen one of the others during those 4 years. And the Marine Corps is not that big an outfit. And yet none of us had seen one another. And we met at dispersing. And I look back on it now, it's interesting. I'd been drinking for 4 years. And I was getting out of the Marine Corps. I'd worked hard, and I worked for a commission, and I was given an appointment to go to Quantico, OCS, and I ended up leading a combat patrol in a blackout. And we took fire and returned fire, I'm told. And fortunately, nobody on our side was hurt. And if it was up to me, nobody on their side was hurt. And I woke up the next morning, and I had a 45 and with a round in the chamber and a hammer back and three rounds missing out of the magazine. And I was fully clothed. I even had a flak jacket on. I rarely slept like that. And I was just, it terrified me. And I knew that the Marine Corps was an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. And so I turned down the commission and I got out, which I hated because I loved the Marine Corps. I loved everything about it. I won Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award, and every promotion I ever got was a meritorious promotion. And I just loved it. You know, I just loved everything about it. And I still love it. I've been in it over 40 years, and I still love it. But I got out, and I lost the first thing that really meant anything to me. And we met at dispersing, and we shook hands and laughed. And somebody said, let's go have a sandwich and a beer. And 4 years later, it's the same thing. And so we went over to the NCO club, and we're sitting around having a sandwich and a beer. And they kept looking at their watches. And I said, what's the hurry? We've been here 4 years. What's another half hour? Well, they had plans. You know, they wanted to do things like go home and get on with their life, see their girlfriends, see their families. And I wanted to do that, too, until I had that first drink. And then I didn't know what the hurry was. And then I talked them into having a second drink, and they're still looking at their watch and everything, and they left. And I stayed. And I had five or six more drinks. And then I started thinking. I started thinking about those MPs that gave me such a hard time in town. And I started thinking about the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And it was explained to me that I would be under the Uniform Code of Military Justice for 24 hours after my discharge. And by now it was about 11 o'clock in the morning, which meant 9 o'clock the following morning, I was a civilian. And so I did what any normal person would do. I went into town. I went to a friend's house. I drank half the night. Next morning I got up. 9 o'clock, I'm a civilian. I'm in my civilian clothes. I go into a bar. These MPs who always gave me a hard time walk by. I had a few things to say to them. They were offended. They came over and grabbed me, at which time I told the bartender to call a policeman because they had just assaulted a civilian. So I wanted to press charges. Now, you know, most folks would have gone home. But I had to stick around to even a score. And it was crazy, just crazy. And, you know, I ended up drinking for 12 years. I was told you earlier, I'll be 59 years old next week. And I have been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous half my life. And what a wonderful blessing, half my life to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went on to drink 8 more years, and I did stuff that that no human being should be allowed to do. But, you know, I really was like a tornado going through the lives of other people. You know, I ended up getting married, and we had our first daughter, Kelly, a lovely, lovely girl. And 9 months later, to the day, I am Irish, we had our second child, and but Kimberly was nearly 3 months premature, and she weighed less than 2 pounds, and she, I was drunk. Of course, I was drunk when she was born, and all I wanted to do was go home and go to sleep because I couldn't handle anything else, and I'd gotten home and just laid down, and my wife called, and she was in hysterics, and she said, "Our baby's not going to live. Would you please come back? I need you to be here." And she was born at the hospital that I worked in, and I went back, still drunk, and this little thing was weighed less than 2 pounds. I could hold her in my hand, and they explained to us that she had a very severe case of hyaline membrane disease. They also explained that no one with that severe a case had ever lived in their experience, they put her on an experimental machine. It's very common now, but it was the first one on the East Coast, and it had been put together 3 days before she was born. And the next 3 days, I discovered everything that I needed to know about me. We had an office across from the neonatal nursery where this little bundle was. And I sat in that room at night with the lights out and the door slightly ajar, watching. I watched my wife walk up and down the hall with a 1,000-yard stare and state of shock. And the third night's particularly difficult, and I watched my wife go in and baptize our little baby because they didn't think she lived through the night. And you know, I knew what to do. It wasn't that I didn't know what to do. I knew what to do because I watched my father. My father was the greatest father and the greatest husband I ever saw in my life. And I knew exactly what my father would have done. He would have bucked up, and he'd have gone in and he'd have put his arm around his wife, and he'd have said, "Darling, with God we can do anything." That's what he'd have said. So I knew what to do and I knew what to say, but there was just nothing left inside of me. And I don't know any other way to explain it. Everything inside of me was gone. There was no fiber, no fabric, no nothing. What I was a sot. I'd get one of those little red baskets and I'd take off. And I'd get, you can get 10 things and go through that fast line. And you know, my heart would be pounding and everything. So every day I do that. Well, one day I'm at the Safeway on, Wisconsin Avenue in Georgetown, and I used to shop over there because they'd kill you where I lived. So I'm got my little red basket and I'm grabbing what I need and I go running through the line. It must have been a slow day or something, you know, because the guy checking stuff out, you know, said, "Pardon me, sir," he said, "you have 11 items." Yeah. He had no idea who he was dealing with. He said, "This is a 10-item line." He had a smile on his face. You know, I mean, he's just joking around. I said, you're right. I don't deserve to shop here. So somebody's behind me, and I turn around. I said, "You know, you can sleep at night because this guy's counting things." And they're looking at me, you know, you know, all they want to do is buy a couple of things and go home and be with their family. And then the manager came over and said, "Sir, what's the matter?" I said, "Nothing." I said, "You got to promote this guy." I said, "He caught me trying to sneak 11 things through. I'm telling you, you know." And I did what any normal person would do. I burst into tears and ran out of there. Now, that's all okay. My mistake was I told my sponsor. I don't curse at the podium, but I will quote my sponsor, okay? He said, "You did what? Get your ass over here." So I went over and explained how unreasonable this man was. I'm a customer. A customer is always right. And all that stuff. So we got in my sponsor's car, and next thing I know, we're driving up Wisconsin Avenue. And there's a Safeway. And he pulled in, and I said, "No, no." He just pointed, you know. So I got out of the car and I went in, and the manager came running over. He said, "Sir, you all right?" I said, "Well, hard life, almost died of alcoholism." Mother had a square nipple. Dad never told me he loved me. So I had to pay for my groceries, and he still had them. And then I had to shop there for the next 6 months. Those were my instructions from my sponsor. And every time I go through that fast line, that guy was there. You know, he'd look at me and go, 1, 2, 3, 4, ha ha. You know. Absolutely out of my mind. And one day I got up, I was sober about 50 days, something like that, and I got up and I going to work, and this is a true story, I forgot where I worked, and I panicked, you know, and I always carried a card with my sponsor's 2 phone numbers and a dime taped to it, and he said, "If you ever need me, you call me." And so I stopped at a phone booth to call my sponsor. Now, you can't let your sponsor know you don't know where you work. I mean, you know, would you want to sponsor somebody who didn't know where they worked? So I called him up and I said, "Good morning, Dan." He said, "Keith, how are you?" I said, "I'm fine. I was wondering how you're doing." And he said, "What's the problem?" "No problem. I was just wondering how you're doing." And he said, "What's that noise?" I said, "I'm calling you from a phone booth." And he said, "Did your car break down?" I said, "No, Dan, car is fine. I was wondering how you're doing." And he said, "What's the matter, buddy?" And I said, "Well," I said, it's not a real big problem, Dan. I can't seem to recall where I work." And he said, "Oh, you got the old 'I can't remember where I work' problem, huh?" He said, "So a lot of us have had that. I'll tell you, I've been around here a while. I've never met another person who had that problem." And then he said to me, "You know, the book says that to pour alcohol in our brain is a very unnatural thing. And he said, it's going to take a while for your brain to get itself straightened out and everything." And I said, "Dan, do you think I might have brain damage?" And he said, "I'll be honest with you, Keith, it's too early to tell." But then he said to me, he said, "May I make a suggestion?" I said, "Anything." I said, "I'm honest, willing, and open-minded." And he said, "If you ever have this problem again," he said, "try to remember to look at the front bumper of your car, because you have a parking sticker for the university." And I'm thinking, where do these people learn these things? You know? I mean, you know, they made life look so easy, you know? You know, I had a deal, too, where I misunderstood how Alcoholics Anonymous worked. I thought that AA, what you did was you found the problem, and then you find the answer for the problem, and then you don't have to drink. I didn't understand it. Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life. We don't worry about problems. I mean, they pass. They either get solved or they don't, you know. AA is just a way of life, but I don't understand it. So I'm problem hunting. And I hung out with a few folks. There were 9 of us, actually, who hung together. It was sort of the problem of the month group. We'd figure out what the problem was, and they'd always send me to the old-timers to get the answer, you know. And the old-timers were not nice people. And they always laughed at my problems. I don't know what they did with theirs, but they laughed at mine. So I'd go with a problem, ha ha, you know. And I remember one problem I had, and this was a secret. I didn't want to tell my sponsor. I was impotent, which will put a crimp in your sex life, in case you're wondering. So I went to this old timer and I told him, well, he loved that one. They love problems about sex, you know. He said, "Oh, a lot of us had that problem, kid. It'll get better." I said, "When?" I really thought it was important. He said, "Wait, you got a full social calendar? So let me guess, you're going to take them to dinner and then take them over to your chateau over in Skid Row and really entertain them. So like a month later, right? I have another problem. I discover another problem. I go back to the same guy. You think I'd learn, you know? So I go back to this guy, and he said to me, he said, "Look, you got a lot of problems, don't you?" I said, "I got a lot of them." He said, "I've noticed every time somebody else has a problem, you have it too." I said, "That's the strangest thing, but you know." And he said, "Let me make a suggestion." I said, "Anything. I'm honest, willing, and open-minded." And he said, "Well, let me suggest that you borrow some lipstick from one of the girls in the program. He said, now, I don't want you to do anything else for the girls in the program. Oh, that's right, you can't. You know. And, so I went and I bought a tube of lipstick. I didn't want to owe anything. And what I was instructed to do was to go home and write on my mirror, Keith, you were wrong. I said to him, I said, well, I can't do that. You see, my problem is I have a poor self-image and I need to be affirmed. Don't ever talk that way to an old-timer. They never read any of those things. And so I wrote on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I just knew they were nuts. It's just crazy. And I threw the thing in a trash can. And I was outraged. And I went to bed. And it was a normal night. Remember normal night? And I closed my eyes. My brain woke up for the first time. It took off, you know. You're never going to make it. They're going to find out you're not an alcoholic. You're really crazy. You're going to be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're infinite. You know, this normal stuff just running through there. You know, 3 hours later, I finally drift off to sleep, and then the leg cramps would set in. I'd be jumping up and down beside my bed. And in 15 minutes before I had to go to work, I go sound asleep. And it would take 3 alarm clocks to wake me. And my mind was ready. You're going to go to work today. They're going to find out you don't know how to do your job, and they're going to fire you. What difference does it make? I'm hopelessly in debt. You know, it's the normal stuff. When I started a coffee, I just wanted to fall on a butcher knife. And I went and I looked on a mirror and said, Keith, you were wrong. I said, well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a lot of trouble. And I discovered that the magnificent thing about being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is being wrong. I mean, the more stuff I can be wrong about, the happier I'm going to be. Just think if it were the way I thought it was. Oh, it would be a terrible world to live in. You know? And you know, the other thing that struck me is, I don't know why, I just fell in love with you folks. I mean, I was going to meetings like 3 weeks, and I just admired you, and I fell in love with you. And I can't think of any other way to describe it. Even those of you I didn't like, I just admired and fell in love with. And I remember one time, and you've always been there. I mean, and you were always there at the right time. The right person has always been there at the right time, and it's an amazing phenomenon. And, you know, and now, you know, I've been around a little while, and usually the right person's a new person. But the right person's always been there. And I remember, the book talks about the time when no human power will keep us from taking a drink. And there came a time when I guess my conscience, a God-given thing that, you know, let me know just how wrong I'd been about so many things and the way I lived my life and the kind of people, the things I did that hurt people and all that stuff. And it finally came around, and you know, the great gift my parents gave me, morality. I mean, just there can't be a greater gift than morality. And I knew right from wrong, and I knew I violated virtually every principle associated with being a human being. And it all sort of came home to me at the same time. And I guess I was sober probably 4, 5, 6 months. And I didn't go to a meeting because I wanted to go to a meeting or I needed a meeting. I went to a meeting because I always went to a meeting. And I just went to this meeting, and it was in my home group, the young people's group, and there was a man there named Harold, Happy Harold, Happy Harold was leading the meeting, and I wanted to hear, but I swear to you, I didn't hear a word anybody said because the noise in my head was so loud. And when the meeting was over on Thursdays, we always went to the Potter's House for ice cream and cake and coffee, and I didn't want to go, but I went because I always went. And habits are so important in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went there, and I was watching. Everybody's mouth was moving, and I wasn't hearing anything. And I finally got up to leave. And I shudder to think what would have happened to me. I mean, I don't know if I'd have drank, but I don't know if I'd have lived. But I got up, and I was leaving, and Happy Harold said to me, he's a beautiful man, he's a black man, and he said, son, he said, you got a minute? And I'm thinking, yeah, I got a minute, and you don't have to hurry off to die, And he said, sit down. He said, I don't know you. And I introduced myself and everything. And he said, you look troubled. I remember, forget that word. He said, you look troubled. I said, I am. And I began to tell him about how guilty I felt about my children. And, you know, they were 3 and 4 years of age and on and on. And when I thought about them, how I burned inside. And, you know, he didn't tell me you shouldn't feel that way. What he said to me was, I know how you feel. And he told me this story. He said, you know, he said my mama was dying in the hospital. And he said, she called me up and said, son, I want you to come tomorrow morning with your brothers and sisters and see me. She said, but if you're drinking, don't come because I don't want to go to an eternity with seeing my oldest boy drunk. And he said, the next morning, he said, I showed up at the hospital and I was drunk. I said, you were? He said, of course I was. Keith, he said, I'm an alcoholic, and back then I didn't have any alternative. The only way I knew to deal with anything was to be drunk. He said, my brothers and sisters said, Harold, you can't go up and see Mama like that. So he called up, and they took a phone to her bedside. And he said, Mama, can I come and see you? And she said, not if you're drinking, son. And he said, my brothers and sisters said goodbye to my mama. And he said, I sat down in the waiting room and she died and I never got to say goodbye to her. I said, how do you live with that? And he smiled only the way Harold can smile. And he said, you'll realize that the worst you do becomes your greatest gift. And I was so overwhelmed with this that I forgot to die. I just went home, went to sleep. It must have been a few months later. I was in the hospital, and there was Harold at the elevator. And I went over, and I shook his hand, and we talked and everything. And so he got on the elevator, and I was walking away, and a nurse said to me, do you know Mr. B? And I said, you mean Happy Harold? She said, you know, he's the finest man I know. And I said, really? She said, yeah. She said, you know, she said, whenever we have an old person over here who's all alone and dying, and they don't have anybody, we call Harold, and he comes and helps them die. And those words rang through my brain, the worst you do becomes your greatest gift. And I'm so glad I didn't give up on my destitute, my morally destitute life. Because God uses everything if I show up and I'm willing. You know, that father who never told me he loved me, I tried to make amends to him. It was amazing. I'd go home. I'd drive from Washington to Ohio to make amends, and I'd be around him. I'd just get angry. I'd get up, go back to Washington. And finally, after about three trips, he said to my mother, he said, you know, I love that boy. He said, but he comes a long way for a cup of coffee. And I had no idea what was going on. And my sponsor kept saying, I think you're getting closer. I think you're getting closer. I just didn't know what to do. And what I've come to realize and what I sincerely believe is that the primary relationship in my life is with my father. I don't know how it is for women, but I know with men and the men I sponsor that the primary relationship is with my father. And if I don't get that one right, I don't get anything else right. If I don't get that right, I can't be a good husband. I can't have a decent relationship with God. I have to get that one right. And for me, it was easy because it was the greatest man who ever lived. But I couldn't see all that. And I went and I made these attempts. Dad, I know I worried you, and on and on. And he'd always say, you know, I always put you in God's arms, and I always knew you were going to be okay. He said, every day I prayed for my 11 children and the kids who hang around here and your mother. And I just knew that God was going to take care of you. And I bought a house down at the ocean, and my parents had never seen the ocean. You don't go on a lot of vacations when you raise 11 children and send them to school. And so they went down, and I moved over to Birmingham for a couple of years in the mid-80s. And I said, Dad, would you keep an eye on the house for me? I said, and he said, yeah, I'll keep an eye on it. I kept an eye on it for 6 years. But it was wonderful because I would always go by, and whenever I was in that part of the country, I'd go by, and I'd just sit with my dad, and we'd just spend time together and talk. And one day, I finally understood why I owed him an amends. We're sitting and just rocking and looking at the ocean, and he said, son, remember when you went to work? And I said, yeah, Dad. I said, I was 12 years old. I said, I went to work in a bowling alley. And he said, yeah. He said, remember your first day at work? I said, no, I don't think I do. And he said, well, he said, I took you to lunch. He said, I took you to Louis Hot Dog Stand. And I said, really? He said, yeah, yeah. He said, you remember what you had? And I said, well, I'll go out on a limb here, Dad. Did I have a hot dog? And he said, of course you did, you loon. Always call me a loon. And he said, but you remember what you drank? And I said, I probably drank orange pop. I always drank orange pop. He said, not that day. He said, that day you drank root beer. He said, I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who work drank root beer. And he said, I explained to you what it is to do a good day's work for a good day's pay. And he said, I explained to you that you owe your boss respect, and your boss owes you respect, and people earn respect. And he was telling his 12-year-old son how to grow up. And he said, I walked you down to the bus stop. And he said, do you want me to come with you the first day? And you said, no, thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, I watched my 12-year-old boy get on the bus. And he said, I watched the bus till it was out of sight, and you never looked back. And he said, from then on, you never let me do anything for you. He said, your brothers and sisters let me help them through college. And he said, you know, you worked your way through college and you bought all your own, worked your way through high school and you bought all your own clothes. I thought that's what I was supposed to do. But the reason I owed my father an amends was I never let him do what he did best, and that was to be a father. And a week later, I borrowed $3,000 from him. You know, I put it in a bank for about a month, and I paid him back. And from that day on, we were just as tight as you could be, because I finally let him do what he did best. And I got to enjoy him for many, many, many sober years. And, you know, he got sick, and I went up to see him this past October. He was pretty sick then, 89 years old, just a magnificent man. And he started taking out those pictures, and he took out the picture of his baseball team when he was in high school, and it said they were state champs and everything. And I said, "Dad," I said, "I heard you were a pretty good ball player." He said, "I was okay." And I said, "Well, Dad, I actually heard that you were all state." He said, "Well, I was." And I said, "Was that your senior year?" He said, "Well, actually, it was all 4 years." and I said, "I heard a rumor somewhere that you were offered a professional contract." He said, "Yeah." He said, "But you know," he said, "Mom and Pop were both sick. And so I went into the factory because that was sure money. How could I have missed all that?" And I said to him, I said, "Dad, why didn't you ever tell me how good you were? And think, listen to this answer." He said, "Well, you and your brother Denny tried so hard to play ball well." He said, "I didn't want to say anything that might discourage you." I said, "Dad, I've been going to meetings for 28 years to learn to think like that, and I can't do it." And you know, I spent a lot of time with him, and this past December, I was with him, and he was in and out of coma, my wife, lovely wife Julia, was there, and I was next to his bed, and I was holding his hand, and I assured him that it was okay to go, to be with his wife, who he'd missed so much, and his son Terry, and I told him that that I'd pray for all the people he prayed for every day, and I kissed him on the cheek and told him it was okay to go, and we all stood around the bed and we prayed, and we prayed the Lord's Prayer, and we said amen, and he squeezed my hand and went into eternity. And I was right with my dad, which means I can be right with the rest of the world. And you know, I sponsor guys who don't know their dads or never saw their dads and all the rest of it, but you know, it's still possible to do. You know, find someone who's like Dad or someone who you'd like to be like Dad, and honor them and come to grips with them and come to grips with your manhood. You know, I can emulate my father. I can be the kind of husband that my father was now. And not because of me, but because of you. You know, I'm married to a woman, and we had one argument 13 years ago. We were married a month, and we had a disagreement, and it was all her fault. But you know what she did? She took my good knives and put them in the dishwasher. And I said to her, I said, "You know, those handles will dry out, and the knives, it'll ruin the knives." And she said, "Well, I just cut chicken with them, and I'm afraid of salmonella poisoning." So, you know, 2 days later, she's putting the same knives back in the dishwasher. She's defying me. Yeah. And I said to her, "Yep," and I started to raise my voice. And I love her more than air, and I'm starting to raise my voice. And I stopped, and I said, "You know, 10 steps says that the axiom says that if there's a problem between me and you, there's a problem with me." I said, "I'm going to go call my sponsor and find out what my problem is." And she said, "Well, I'm going to call my sponsor and find out what my problem is." Yeah. And I talked to Tom, and I came back, and I said to her, I said, "You know, I've got a big decision to make here, big decision." You know, I said, "Now, do I want to hurt the person I love more than anybody in the world, or 25 years from now, do I want to buy another knife?" Now, you know, the knives are hanging in there. I mean, they aren't quite as nice as I'd like them to be, but the other side of it, in 13 years, we have not had one case of salmonella poisoning. And, you know, I want to wrap it up quickly. There are just so many things that I want to say, and being here has just been so important to me. And, you know, if you're new, we do have a lot of fun. I swear we do. And all that stuff inside is going to get all straightened out, and the thinking and everything. It's going to happen. It happens because we associate with people who have been down this trail before. So the end of this month, I'll be in Tampa Bay with my grand sponsor Cecil and my sponsor Tom and a guy I sponsor, Steve, and we're going to be doing a thing on sponsorship, oddly enough. And and you know, for me to be part of something like that, you know, 151 years of continuous sobriety, and we're going to be together. And I guess the key to all of this is that I belong. Now, you know, that's not much for a lot of people, but for an alcoholic, belonging is an awful lot. You know, even when I was in the Marine Corps, and God, I loved the Marine Corps, but I knew they made a mistake. I knew they had the wrong guy. And now wherever I am, I belong. And I don't take up much space. I take up more than I used to, unfortunately, but I don't take up much space. But wherever I'm standing is where God wants me to be. And you know, to a non-alcoholic, that doesn't mean much. But, you know, to an alcoholic, it means everything in the world. And if I'm in town, I should have stayed in town. If I'm out of town, I should have gone out of town. And you know, when I was drinking, if I stayed in town, I should have gone out of town. And if I went out of town, I should have stayed in town. I never belonged where I was. And it sounds silly, but to belong where you are is magnificent. You know, I am extremely active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And somebody said to me one time, I've had some recent health problems, and so my doctor wants me to slow down. And I did something that surprises even me. I asked my wife to help me make judgments about decisions. I said, you know, you've got a real stake in this thing, and your judgment about me is a heck of a lot better than my judgment, and would you help me make decisions? And she said, I'd be honored to be part of your life in that way and to make decisions. And so I'm trying to work out, you know, what all I'm going to be doing. I was going 38 weekends last year, and that's just a lot of time on airplanes and things. And again, my health is suffering a little bit. You know, you get as old as me, it's supposed to start to suffer. And yet somebody said to me, you know, why do you go so much? And the honest answer is, I owe you so much that I can't pay the interest on the principal. I owe you everything in my life. I owe you every relationship I have. And most of all, I owe you peace of mind, and I owe you a relationship with my higher power. You know, when I was doing my ninth step work, one of the things I hated were religious people because they frightened me. And on my eighth step list said religious people. And so I went looking for a religious person, and I went to a retreat center. And I was walking around looking for a religious person, and I saw an old guy sitting in a room rocking in a rocking chair reading his breviary. And I asked him if I could talk to him, and he's an old priest, and he welcomed me in, and I sat down, and I told him why I was there. And I was frightened, and I told him why I was there, and that the things I'd said about people like him, and I just wanted to come and tell him how very sorry I was. And he listened to me for a little while. And I'll never forget this. He got up, and he pulled me up, and he put his arms around me, and he began to pat me. And he said, God sent you. I said, excuse me? He said, God sent you. He said, you know, he said, I have an illness that will allow me to go home soon. And he said, I've been a priest for 50 years. And he said, I was just asking my higher power where I missed it. And he said, you know, son, he said, too many times during these 50 years, I've forgotten what my higher power told me. He told me to not to hang around with the 99 who agree with me, but to go after the one who was lost. And he said, I'm sorry you had to be out there all alone. And I got some kind of an insight into how people, spiritual people live their lives. All they do is the best they can one day at a time. And that's all I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not asked to do it perfectly. I'm not even asked to do it very well. I only have one goal in life. My goal is to be a better husband, a better friend, a better sponsor, a better pigeon, a better father, a better grandfather this time next year than I am this time this year. And if I'm not, I've missed it. If I'm not, I've missed it. If I'm not, I haven't taken advantage of what you've given me. You know, when I was sober about 7 years, I moved from Washington, D.C., where I got sober, to North Carolina. And golly, I love North Carolina. And I had recently had a profound spiritual awakening, and I'd come to know my higher power to be reintroduced to him. And I was sitting out on the balcony of this apartment overlooking a lake, and it was just one of those moments, and I was overwhelmed with gratitude, And I was reading a big book and a big book, and I just said aloud, "Why me, Father? Why have you picked me?" And I was reminded of when I was in that little treatment center and I called that poor woman I had tormented so. And I said to her, I said, "I'm an alcoholic." She said, "No kidding." And I said, "Why me?" She said, "Why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do." And she hung up. And here I am, 7 years later, asking God as I understand him, "Why me, Father?" And he said to me, "Why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do." And what I've come to realize is that what I have as a result of you in my life is what he wanted for me all along. And that is just to belong, to be of value, an opportunity to be of service, and most of all, to experience the peace that he has for all his little princes and princesses. Thank you very much.